This is 6 o'clock, and this is KBOO Portland. Next up is the KBOO Youth Collective's public affairs show, The Underground.
I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me.
And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be.
And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries.
That's me.
Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy?
Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be happy?
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Youth Underground. Tonight, our theme for our show is war and conflict. You'll be hearing some pieces this evening about World War II, about an interview with a band which has nothing to do with war or conflict, but is good. And right now, you're going to be hearing a piece about the Portland Public Schools reconfiguration done by Sean Biggers.
On April 4th, Portland Public Schools Superintendent Vicki Phillips released a plan to reconfigure Portland schools. The proposal would create 17 new kindergarten through 8th grade schools, but the plan would affect up to 26 schools because some would be closed and consolidated into other locations. Since the proposal was released, there have been 11 public input meetings for the masses to give their feedback on the plan. The community definitely has plenty to say. Some support it, some say it's too much and too soon. I went out to a few of these public meetings and asked lots of questions about the plan, and in particular, how the community and how students have been engaged in creating the plan. Kathy Mintzberg, the PPS Chief Operating Officer, told me about how district staff created the plan.
There's no easy way to get a proposal developed. The folks who do this work every day, who have expertise, need to sit down and think. And they do, and they put a proposal on the table. People then get to react to it.
So community engagement has basically been limited to public meetings. The plan is made behind closed doors, released to the world, and then people have a chance to say what they think. But they don't have much of a chance. The school board is going to vote on the reconfiguration plan on May 1st, less than a month after the plan was made public. Some of the proposed changes wouldn't take effect until the fall of 2007, and some even later. Mintzberg says that gives more time for community input, but I don't think that that matters unless community and student engagement is more meaningfully utilized in the future. When I asked Mintzberg about current student engagement in the reconfiguration process, she offered a few examples.
Well, students have been involved like many of their parents. They come to presentations, they get to hear what's being proposed, they get to then react. We have a student board member who sits there and reviews the information and takes it back to the representative group that represents all of our students.
There's a few problems with that answer. The student representative on the school board isn't allowed a real vote. Plus, it's not an elected position anyways. And then the student group that represents students on the district level, called the Superintendent Student Advisory Council, hasn't been approached to give their feedback on the reconfiguration plan. I also asked Mintzberg how the rest of the student body is being engaged, perhaps on a school-wide or class-by-class basis. She said that many schools are initiating discussions, but that they are not being organized by students.
Our students get to sit locally with their own schools and react to the plans that are being developed for their campus. So at that point, it's appropriate for the principal and the parent and staff leadership at the school to involve students as they see appropriate.
I wasn't surprised to hear that students weren't allowed leadership roles in these discussions, but at least it's being talked about. I spoke with some students at Portsmouth Middle School to hear what they had to say about the discussions at their school. Here's Claudia Escobar.
Yes, we have talked about it in one of my teachers, Ms. Tuggle's class. She gave us an example essay. It's persuasive why it should or shouldn't be allowed. As an eighth grader, we represent Portsmouth, and it's really important for our voice to be heard, too, because it's like it's our school. We went there for 3 years.
That's exactly what we need more of, but with essays being submitted to the district and being genuinely utilized. Students, teachers, and administrators need to work together as equal partners to direct our education system and our school reform. There are many ways student engagement could be improved for similar decisions in the future. Before plans like these are ever made public, the district needs to work collaboratively with the Superintendent Student Advisory Council to develop a proposal. After the proposal is released, student government groups at each school should be given the authority to lead discussions and feedback opportunities at their campus. The student assembly at Portsmouth Middle School is a perfect example. Here's Paul Steger, the principal of Portsmouth.
We have student government here. So each of the classrooms, each of the homerooms have representatives that go to the weekly meeting. So the questions can go back to the students, or the students can go ahead and raise the questions.
Similar student government groups with membership from every classroom during a specific period exist at other schools like Grant, Madison, and Lincoln. These groups need to be tapped. It's that kind of meaningful, active engagement that the organization I work for, the Intercom Project, advocates. Some friends and I created the Intercom Project because young people have the right to act as leaders in schools and government, and we want to see that right recognized and respected. We're in the early pilot phase of our existence, and we'd love to get more people involved. If you're interested, feel free to give us a call at 971-222-4153 or email us at intercomproject@gmail.com.
And that was Sean Bigger with a report on student engagement in the Portland Public Schools reconfiguration plan. This next piece, although not directly related to the theme of war and conflict, at least literally, is about various issues and conflict currently taking place outside of the United States.
It has come to my attention that while many Americans are indulging in Cosmopolitan's latest summer wear advice and topless guy articles, or the ever-popular GQ magazine stress test or photo gallery of Tom Cruise, many more devastating things are taking place all over the world. While we might catch glimpses of troops in Iraq being sent home, or large explosions happening somewhere far away, our easily accessible media does not give its viewers a good enough idea of what's really going on. Breaking news on the CBS website consists of government officials traveling, actresses getting arrested for drunk driving, and the most beautiful people of 2006 list. Nowhere did it mention the bombings in Egypt that have been taking place over the last few weeks, or the French protests earlier this month over labor laws affecting young workers. Personally, I have a problem with this. Not because I dislike topless guys or sexy swimsuits, but because there's more important things to me than who's the prettiest celebrity of 2006. Because I feel that mainstream media has been doing a less than average job of keeping the people informed. I've taken it upon myself to give a brief newscast covering just a few stories that have been less touched upon. In the Czech Republic, 12 cases of bird flu have been found in dead swans. The virus has been identified as H5N1, the deadly bird flu virus that's been flying its way around Europe and Asia. In Nepal, soldiers shot a crowd of protesters, killing six and injuring at least 11 individuals. The crowd was protesting outside of an army base. The protest was initiated because of rumors that a 22-year-old woman was raped and shot by soldiers. Meanwhile, Pakistan police are searching for a girl's parents and two cousins after the girl was brought to a hospital to treat 5 gunshot wounds. The girl says that she was attacked by her two cousins after one of her cousins was denied her hand in marriage. The girl was shot 5 times and left for dead in a gutter. She managed to crawl to help and is now recovering. Apparently, this kind of abuse to females is often seen in Pakistan and considered a type of honor killing. Egypt has been experiencing a number of bombings, the most recent being a case of 2 suicide bombers. The first blew himself up while a car with 2 members of the Multinational Forces and Observers Group, a peacekeeping group, was passing. The second blew himself up about 45 minutes later next to a police vehicle. Both bombers failed in destroying their targets. In Chile, 48 bodies recently discovered were wrongfully identified. Currently, people are trying to sort everything out and get the right bodies back to their families. Zimbabwe is facing severe health fees as hospitals are raising their fees. This is believed to help provide better care for those that come to the hospital. Zimbabwe has the lowest life expectancy, with the average age being under 40. A small triumph for the African nation. Nigeria has become the first in the African nation to pay off its debt to other countries. Nigeria was among one of the many places in debt to the Paris Club, a group of 19 lenders who supply money to countries in need. Now that Nigeria is free of debt, it can easily start to rebuild itself. Although Nigeria is one of the biggest oil exporters, it is a very poor country with most of its population living on less than a dollar a day. I hope that although this piece was a distraction from shopping for the perfect administrative professional gift and lusting over those pictures of Tom Cruise, that it served as a source of helpful and insightful information. With the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Brianna.
This piece was collected from CNN.com, National Public Radio, the British Broadcasting Corporation, CBSNews.com, and, of course, Cosmopolitan and GQ Magazine. Next up is Ember interviewing Chris Knutson from Recruiter Watch, Portland.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
So first off, I just want to ask you what exactly Recruiter Watch is, if you can tell us a little bit about the history and what you guys do.
Well, Recruiter Watch is a coalition group that started in August of 2005. It's a loose coalition of a couple different groups that are coming together. We have some people from the Veterans for Peace chapters, American Friends Service Committee, the GI Rights Hotline, National Lawyers Guild, Code Pink, some of the local unions, and then some high school student groups.
Oh, and how did you get involved with them? What brought you to working with Recruiter Watch?
I had met a few people that were involved with the program, and I work at a high school in the North Clackamas School District. We work with a lot of students who are looking to continue their education past high school. One of the problems that we normally have, though, with those students is that they don't have the economic resources to continue their education. So looking at those situations, while at the same time noticing how much money is going into the military budget, seemed like a kind of contradiction of interests. So that's what brought me into the fold.
And so what exactly does Recruiter Watch do? Like, how would you define what your mission statement or so forth?
Right now, the main thing that we're focusing on is we're trying to pass a resolution to the school board, and that resolution is focusing on ending military recruiter abuse. A lot of that is focused on the behavior that military recruiters can have on the high school campuses. They have been given full access to high school campuses as of late since the No Child Left Behind Act has been passed. They've been provided reasonable access to high school campuses, which basically means they have the same right to access a high school campus as any post-secondary institution has. So any colleges or any professional training programs, now military recruiters are supposed to be provided with that same access.
And how does that pan out in the real world? Like, what are you seeing around campuses and schools with the military recruiters?
Some of the folks who had been involved on the first day of school, they've been outside passing out some information at Franklin High School, mainly focusing on the opt-out option that students have to make sure that the school isn't passing out their private information to the military recruiters. And they were saying that during the time that they had been on campus, they had seen recruiters on campus on the very first day of school. And some of the things that happen are they'll come out with flashy equipment, they'll come to campus armed, basically putting on a spectacle for the students, making the military options look really glamorous. And there's also been a lot of cases of military recruiters kind of misleading students, telling them that there's no way they'll be sent to Iraq, telling them that they won't be involved in frontline combat. And, of course, these are things that they can't really legitimately promise to people. And another main issue that Recruiter Watch is focusing on is the misproportionate amount of attention that military recruiters are spending at specific schools, schools that traditionally have more students of color, more students of socioeconomic backgrounds that are kind of pushing them towards a military career as opposed to having those traditional options like college or other professional career-type options.
And what kind of projects is Recruiter Watch working on right now to get these things across? We were talking earlier about a big event that's coming up. Do you want to explain a little more about that?
Sure. On Monday, May 8th, there's going to be a march and rally. It's starting at the Fountain in Holiday Park at 5 o'clock p.m. on Northeast Multnomah between 11th and 13th Avenues. We'll be marching to the Military Recruitment Center on Broadway between 13th and 14th, and then to the Blanchard Education Service Center at 501 North Dixon, where they'll be having a school board meeting. And this is basically just to get the school board to start paying attention and hopefully gain a sympathetic ear from them and from the public as a whole.
So that's your guys' big project. Are you guys working on any, like, smaller projects on the side right now, or is that taking up most of your time for the moment?
We have a few of us that are splitting off onto separate mini-projects. We have some folks that are trying to do more of a youth outreach type program, working within the high schools and trying to get students to organize themselves so they can feel a little bit more empowered in the actions that they're taking. And again, part of the beauty about this group is that since we have such a wide range of people, we have pretty wide access to different avenues of approaching this. We have some really amazing organizers who work with Vets for Peace. A few of our members are 20-year veterans of armed services. And I think something like that, having them on our side, is a little bit more powerful than the traditional young activism, because they're someone who brings a good degree of experience to the equation. And then there's just a few other plans that we have, but the main thing that we're really trying to focus on right now is getting the school board to take this up as an issue.
And what do you personally find to be, like, the most exciting thing about working with Recruiter Watch?
I'd say the ability to spread out some of the education that we're trying to get out to people, letting them know about some of the issues that recruiters have been doing with students, such as misleading them, spreading some questionable propaganda to students. There's also there's a really interesting case that's about to get pressed in New York City now. The New York City Civil Defense, Civil Lawyers Union, I believe, they're filing a suit on behalf of six teenage students in high school. They're pressing a lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld for the database that the Pentagon is building up. They're saying that this database, which includes their ethnicity, their social security numbers, family background, their grades, all kinds of information about the student, all of this stands in direct violation to the Privacy Act of 1974. So a lot of these different issues kind of tie in together, and just seeing the opportunity to be able to educate the public on some of this is probably the most exciting thing.
And have you come into any big challenges? Like, have you, you know, ran into people who are just really, like, anti what you're doing, or had any trouble with people? Or?
I haven't personally. I've only been working with the group for a couple weeks now. So my actual experience with working in the public sector has been kind of limited. But from what I understand, we've had some really good responses from some of the faculty and some of the students in the high schools in the Portland area.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to get involved, is there a number they could contact? Or
The easiest way would probably to be drop an email to pamrcoalition@yahoo.com. That's pamrcoalition@yahoo.com. And just drop us a line, and someone is normally pretty good at responding to people right away. We also have meetings about once every 2 weeks or so. So it's pretty easy to get in touch with us.
Excellent. And I think we're getting about ready to wrap up here, but is there any few last words you'd like to add? Anything we didn't cover in my questions?
Just one thing that I want to point out. The military recruiters have a general handbook that the recruiters are given for their work to do. And one of the really striking statements that they have is the objective of the recruiters is the goal is school ownership that can only lead to a greater number of Army enlistments. And a phrase like that is pretty strongly worded for a reason. School ownership doesn't mean that they're looking to work with the school. They're working to control that school and have complete and unbridled access to those school's resources. And by resources, that's students. And repeatedly throughout the handbook, they refer to meeting students as a point of sales. So this is their marketing strategy. And when you refer to human beings, and especially young human beings, as a point of sales or as a marketing ploy, that kind of gives you a clear example of where they're really coming from.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us here tonight. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Awesome. And, thank you again for having me. And if anyone can make it to the May 8th rally, that would be great to see everyone.
All right. Take care, and we'll see what's up next in the air room in just a second.
That was Amber interviewing Chris Knudsen from Recruiter Watch PDX. You are listening to The Underground, the Youth Public Affairs Show. And
A group of students created this next segment to increase awareness and combat stereotypes about diversity in Portland public schools. I'll let them introduce themselves.
We are Youth Innovation for Education, a group of young people dedicated to increasing youth voice and improving education. Our program tonight focuses on diversity in Portland public schools. We hope this will challenge you to think critically about your school and yourself and inspire you to work to improve both.
We asked students of Portland Public High Schools four questions related to diversity within the district. The questions we asked were, do you attend your neighborhood school? If you transferred to attend another school, why? In your opinion, is your school more or less diverse than other Portland Public High Schools? Do you identify with the minority or majority of people in your school, and how does this affect you? And which Portland Public High Schools do you feel are the most and least diverse?
We researched the ethnic makeup of Portland public high schools and found that often students' guesses as to which schools were the most and least diverse had some basis in fact. About one quarter of the students surveyed said they thought that Lincoln was the least diverse high school in Portland public schools. Lincoln does have the lowest percentage of American Indians,
0.6%,
African Americans,
4.4%,
and Hispanic students,
also 4.4%.
Lincoln also ranks second to Wilson in percentage of European Americans. This race makes up 81.9% of Lincoln and 83.8% of Wilson. Jefferson has the lowest percentage of European Americans with 13.4% of students. Jefferson is the only school in which European Americans are a minority. 65.9% of Jefferson students are African American, compared to Lincoln's 4.4%. Benson Polytechnic, the school with the most transfers, due to it being a science and technology magnet, is the only school with the highest percentage of Asian Americans.
21.3%.
Only 4.7% of Grant's students are Asian Americans. Grant also has a very small percentage of Hispanic American students,
4.8%,
compared to Roosevelt's 17.8%. This contradicts about one-sixth of the students we surveyed who thought Grant was the most diverse Portland public high school.
There are other kinds of diversity besides ethnicity. Location, economic status, religion, and sexual orientation also separate students from their peers. Sometimes even the schools you previously attended will make a difference.
They all went to middle school together and can relate to one another, so the way they may feel about one thing, I may feel the opposite way.
Sometimes religion can create even more segregation than race.
Being Jewish is a challenge when there are events on a Friday night, Saturdays, and Jewish holidays. I find that I am sometimes set back from my classmates when I need to miss school for the holidays.
Diversity can also create tensions in schools.
As part of class council, it takes more work and effort to involve the Hispanic minority in school events and leadership because of the possible language barriers and outcast feelings.
One student said,
I like having lots of different people to go to school with.
It's good to know that we are taking steps in the right direction in recognizing potential problems while appreciating our fellow students for who they are.
This is Youth Innovation for Education speaking. We are a group of about 10 young people between the ages of 13 and 21 who were one of 8 sites across the country given a grant by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation 2 years ago. Youth do not always have the ability to play an active role in their community, so we're trying to increase youth voice and engagement. We also want to improve education through service learning. In the next 2 years, we will record monthly segments like this one for the Youth Collective. We will also produce a few television shows for the Portland Public School District's channel, that's Channel 28, write a student newsletter to be distributed in all the Portland Public Schools, and create service learning curriculum for Portland Public Schools. We're recruiting new members, so contact Lacey Hawkins at lacey.m.hawkins@co.multnomah.or.us, and Lacey is L-A-C-Y. Thanks for listening. This is KBOO Community Radio.
Youth Foundation for Education hopes that your personal perception about diversity in Portland public schools were challenged by learning some facts and hearing some personal stories about this issue. If you would like to get involved, that email again is lacym.hawkins@co.multnomah.or.us. Zoe Loringer took this opportunity to interview her grandparents, Vern and Nancy, about their experiences being children during World War II.
World War II, the global military conflict that took place between 1939 and 1945. The war began between Germany and the Allies. Ended on 2nd of September 1945 with the formal surrender of Japan. I'm going to interview my grandma and my grandpa.
Your grandmother's name is Nancy.
Well, hello, Nancy.
Hello.
And what is my grandpa's name?
It used to be Vern. It still is.
I'm going to ask you a few questions on World War II. How old were you?
I was 6 years old.
And I was 7 years old at the time.
I lived in Bandon, Oregon. It was on the Oregon coast.
When they bombed Pearl Harbor, I was in Portland with my parents, and we were on our way to Seattle, where my dad had gotten a job in a shipyard.
We lived on the coast, so certain parts of the coast that we had gone to play, we weren't allowed to go anymore. And, of course, no one tells kids why. I didn't find out until afterwards that they had gun emplacements, you know, in these particular places. And we had blackouts where you had to have very dark shades on your windows at night so that no light would show on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember gathering up foil, you know, like the foil that comes in boxes. Now we used, at that time, we would gather it up and put it in balls, and we saved it and shipped it somewhere to help for the war effort. I'm not quite sure what they did with them. And we had stamps. You had to have stamps for gasoline. You had to have stamps for shoes. And stamps for sugar, because it was not in a plentiful supply, so that way everyone got their fair share.
We were in the same situation as far as shortages of just about everything, and having stamps for, you had so many stamps that were allotted to a family for gasoline to drive a car, and if you ran out of that, you waited until next month. Get some more stamps. We lived in South Seattle, up on the hill above Boeing Field. And, of course, they built a lot of planes for the war effort. And one of the unique things that they had is they used to raise up barrage balloons. Now, these are a smaller version of the Goodyear blimp, except they weren't motorized. They just went up on heavy cables up into the air. They were filled with helium, and they put them several hundred feet to 1,000 or more feet up into the air. And that was to discourage any enemy planes from coming in, because they'd get tangled up in those things. I used to have the pictures of all the enemy planes in silhouette, so that if I ever saw one, that I could call up the authorities. I never saw one.
How did it affect our life? Well, you know, as kids, you just sort of accepted it. And you knew that you had to take care of, like your shoes, for instance, because if they wore out before you got stamped for the next pair, and each family was only allotted so many stamps, and there was like four of us kids. So it affected us that way. And, of course, there was no candy bars. I can remember how excited everybody became after the war ended and we started getting candy bars to buy again.
Fresh meat was kind of hard to come by.
Oh, that's true, too.
And we would get all excited when we went to the store and there was some nice red hamburger there. And so it wouldn't last long. Everybody would be there to buy it up, only to find out that it was horse meat.
I don't think I'd appreciated it if I'd have known it was horse meat. But, of course, we had to save everything because everything was sent, supposedly, saved for the soldiers overseas. That was the purpose of our sacrifices.
We would go to the movies. Now, we didn't have, like, newsreel or, you know, news on television. We had it on the radio. You could hear it, listen to it on the radio. But we had newsreels at the movies, and they showed you pictures of what was going on at the time. And as a child, it was quite frightening. Some of it was very scary, where the Holocaust, where the Germans were doing away with the Jews and things like that. I saw a lot of that when I was a kid, and I can remember it, unfortunately. The feeling that I remember most is patriotic. It was the only war that I can remember, and I've unfortunately been around a few of them now, where I really felt like we were, these little things we were doing were helping the soldiers, and the flag and the feeling of patriotism really meant something.
Yeah, that's true, and you know, the movies that were made actually were patriotic movies, a lot of them. There were more war movies, and almost all of them had a patriotic twist to them.
Probably what we'd call propaganda now.
Well, yeah, I guess it would be propaganda, but still, it was the way everyone felt at the time, you know.
That's true. I had an uncle. My mom's only brother was in that war, and he is still living. He lives in Roseburg. I remember the letters that we got from him that were censored. Part of it would just be blacked out because they had to be so careful about what they sent in the mail.
My Uncle Bruce lived in Roseburg, and talking about patriotic feelings, yeah, he was too old to be drafted, but he volunteered and went into the service. And he was a dollar-a-year man. He volunteered his time without pay. The Second World War was a case of survival where the enemy was intent on taking over our country and making slaves out of us. It was a different kind of war than we see today.
Iraq is a war we should have never been involved in the first place. In World War II, we were attacked in Hawaii. We were bombed. Our ships were bombed in Hawaii. We went into Iraq preemptively, and really, I feel in a place that we didn't even belong. I don't think it's our business to get tied up in other people's politics and decide who can and cannot be in control of their country.
We always used to pride ourselves on saying that we would never start a war, but we'd always finish it. This is one we started.
Approximately 62 million people died in the war. Most were civilians as the result of large-scale aerial bombings of cities, disease and starvation, and genocide. It is guessed that the Soviet Union suffered around 23 million deaths, and that China suffered about 10 million. Poland suffered the most deaths in the proportion to its population of any country, losing 5.6 million out of a pre-war population of 34.8 million.
That was Zoe Loringer, edited by Brianna Loringer. This next piece is, actually, it's not a piece, it's going to be an interview. It's by Ben Tu, and they'll be talking about a friend that's going and joining the Army.
Oh, hey, my name is Ben, and today I have a friend of mine in the studio who is going to speak about how she is choosing a new direction for her life that may not seem like an obvious choice. But could you introduce yourself?
My name is Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lunch lady at PSU.
And so things are not quite going exactly the way you'd want in your everyday to life. Being a lunch lady isn't really working out that well for you.
Yeah, well, I enjoy what I do, but it seems like real stagnant. There's no, you know, there's no moving up from lunch lady. And, yeah.
Yeah, I can relate. I am basically a lunch person myself, except for an evil corporation.
Oh, I can guarantee mine is eviler than yours.
Well, we can probably get into this later, but I doubt that. But to get yourself maybe out of this rut, I don't know if I should say rut, maybe.
That works.
Move along in your life a little. You've decided to join the Army?
Yes.
Okay. How did you come to that decision?
That is, like, the one question that I really can't even answer for myself. But one day I just kind of walked into a military recruiting office just to kind of check it out and ask some questions. And it turned out that, like, it seems like the Army can give me almost everything I'm looking for right now. And I was surprised, and my family, and I don't know of anyone who was ever like, wow, I totally would have expected this from you, Ariel. But most people think it's a good idea.
Yeah, because this isn't sort of the thing that anybody would see you doing.
Yeah.
Could you go over a short list of those things that the Army can offer you that appeal to you?
Well, you know, pay, training, the chance to go overseas is really important for me. Like, with the way my job is going and things like that, I really can't save up any money. And I grew up in Japan, and I really want to go back, but I don't have the money to do that, and the Army can give me the opportunity to do that. And even if I end up in Germany or anywhere else, I'd like to go overseas. And I know that Iraq is a pretty big possibility.
Yeah.
But honestly speaking, Iraq has got to be the most interesting place to be right now in its time and place. So, I don't find it to be that bad of a thing.
And, yeah, undeniably Iraq would be a very interesting place to be. Just that interestingness does not necessarily take into account the possible danger, but definitely would be fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you actually researched the whole deal on your own?
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time. I have a massive amount of books about it. My mom works for someone who is in the Army Reserves, and she gave me all these books about basic training and what it's like for a woman to be in the military and things like that. And I read all of them, which was a lot of work. But it seems like it's just going to be, like, the weirdest summer camp I've ever gone to for, like, 3 years.
Good way to look at it. I don't really know anything about what they do put you through in boot camp, but is there arts and crafts? Or?
No, not a lot of that. You know, it's all just... You spend a lot of time in classrooms, and they teach you all the rules because military life is nothing like normal life. You know, there's all this respect crap that happens. And,
totally.
So you spend a lot of time in classrooms, and then there's all that, like, you know, push-ups and digging holes and learning how to shoot things. But
and climbing over large barriers, making yeah, through all that ropes.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm probably going to be there in August, which is going to be pretty intense. But I don't know.
You don't know where you're going to be going for training. Is it not going to be in Arizona, hopefully? Or?
No. What I hear is most women go to Georgia or South Carolina. And Georgia in August seems like the worst place to be.
Seems pretty bad. I don't know. I chose Arizona because that place seems like the closest you can get to hell on Earth, especially in the summer.
Yeah, but it's a dry hell.
A dry hell. Instead of
Georgia's nice and moist.
Oh, yeah. No good. So, moving on from that, how far have you gone in the process of getting yourself set up for this?
Well, I went through all the testing, and that went pretty well, except for a few years ago I had a stroke, and because of that there's all this medical records and stuff that they had to look at, and I guess I have a heart problem. that they're kind of concerned about. But it really isn't a big deal. Like, 25% of people have the same heart problem. So I'm trying to get a medical waiver right now, and that's taking forever just because I'm dealing with civilian doctors and things like that. So I'm just kind of waiting, and probably in about 2 weeks I'll be signing a piece of paper.
And you don't know much about what you're actually going to be doing if you or when you get sent overseas, what your duties will be?
I haven't decided yet. With the Army, all those things like that are guaranteed. Before you sign up, I can say, like, I want to be a cook, and they can't force me to do anything else. Hmm. And if they can't guarantee me a job as a cook, I don't have to sign anything. But, you know, there's a lot of things that I could do. I could do something super rugged and be working on tanks in Iraq. And, you know, that seems kind of interesting to me right now. But once I get this waiver, I'll be able to sit down with a guidance counselor. The Army has guidance counselors, and we're going to figure out what it is that I should be doing.
And they may send you some schooling and...
Yeah. After boot camp, there's advanced individual training, which is like 3 months or so. Wow. And then you get sent to wherever you're going.
Well, I think we may be wrapping this up here. But I'd like to thank you very much for sharing your viewpoint.
Thank you.
And telling us about the whole Army process that you're going through. And so, thank you very much, Ariel.
You're welcome.
It was Ben 2 interviewing Ariel about joining the military. And the next piece is, for 28 years, the DePaul Treatment Center has been working to create freedom from the drug and alcohol addiction. The DePaul Youth Residential Treatment Center opened in 1985. These are some of the current residents of the program.
Well, I'm Joseph, I'm 16, and...
I'm Allie, and I'm 16.
My name's Rebecca, and I'm 16.
Hi, I'm Hustle, I'm 17.
My name's John Wolf, I'm 18 years old right now.
My name's White Man.
My name's Natasha, and I'm 16.
And this be DJ Webb.
My name is Nene, and I'm 18 years old.
My name's Deuce, I'm 18 years old.
What's up, G? I'm B, I'm 19 years old.
My name's Jennifer, and I'm 17.
I'm B with KBOO Radio Station, and I've got another youth that would like to share his story.
I'm going to ask you,
how many days have you been clean?
How has your life changed since being in recovery? And how do you feel about it?
My life's changed a lot since I've been in recovery. I've been in recovery for about 8 months now. I was into smoking dope, methamphetamines. There's a whole life surrounded by that, you know. I was into hitting licks, crueling mad, you know what I'm saying, doing identity theft, all kinds of stuff. There's a whole different world out there, you know, you're not even normal, you know. It took me from being a good relationship with my mother, you know what I mean, to not even being able to be around her, man. I was always getting into trouble, man, stealing cars. And that's what got me in here, you know. I stole a car, got a high-speed chase, you know what I mean, wrecked and pretty much totaled the vehicle and whatnot. It takes over your life, you know. Right now I'm in DePaul Youth Treatment Center. Just got here yesterday from a lockup facility. I'm looking to do good here, you know what I'm saying, get out and change my life.
I've been clean 6 months, and I've been a different person since I stopped using, and I've got closer to my family, and my family is starting to trust me, and they're starting to understand where I'm coming from ever since I stopped using.
I started using crystal meth when I was 12 years old with my older brothers. My life really went downhill and didn't really care about any family get-togethers, any of my family's birthdays, celebrations, anything like that. So I kind of got disconnected. I didn't care about nothing or no one except for my addiction. 6 months ago, I got back into DePaul Treatment Center, and I got 10 months clean right now, and my life's totally a 180. My mom just had a wedding, and I was involved in that. I had pretty much the time of my life. Right now, I worry about school, you know, how I'm going to get a paycheck, and about all my struggles, instead of just worrying about how I'm going to get to cover up all my feelings. I just want everyone to know who's out there using and abusing, you know, running and gunning, that that's not the way it should be. There's always the better way, and to put their feelings out there if they want help.
I've been clean about 4 months. I'm a lot closer with my family, and I'm a lot more stress-free. I have a real home to be at. And that's different for me. I haven't had a home before.
My life has changed a lot, actually, since I've been in recovery. Like, right now I've got 19 months clean and sober. If you grew up with me, you wouldn't even know who I was now. You know what I'm saying? It's an amazing thing. I mean, I started using when I was 13 years old. I didn't care about anybody, you know what I'm saying? First it started, I was just smoking bud. It was fun at first, but it got scary real quick. By the time I was 16, I dropped out of high school. I lost my little brother. I lost everybody in my family, man. Nobody wanted me around, you know what I'm saying? I couldn't hold down a relationship or anything. I OD'd four times in about a three-week period before I got locked up. And, I mean, everything has changed since then. I got locked up. First 30 days are the hardest, you know what I'm saying? But it gets easier and easier after that. And, I mean, I wouldn't trade those first 30 days of hell for anything, for just one day getting high, you know what I'm saying? Now everything's looking up. I'm about to graduate treatment. I got 19 months clean and sober. I'm seeing a beautiful girl. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't trade anything.
I've been clean for 15 days, and me and my mom are getting along better since I haven't been using, and I can be there for my little brother.
I've been clean for 62 days. Before, you know, I'd snort coke, smoke buds, and drink. Those were my drug of choice, and now that I could clearly think, it's all good. I haven't really experienced much. I've gone to my cousin's quince and had fun without drinking, without snorting, without smoking. And I didn't really need it. Now that I'm clean, it feels good to hang out with clean and sober people. I've been high for 6 years of my life, and, you know, it's changed quite a bit. I don't think the same. I don't act the same.
I've been clean 70 days. My clean date is January 14th, 2006. And, well, being clean and sober has opened a lot of doors for me that never would have been open. Things are really looking up for me. I'm getting my GED right now. I'm doing a lot of things. I'm getting, you know, my kids, and I'm going to be getting into independent living and all of that. So everything's really opening up for me now that I'm in recovery.
I got much love for the Rose City. I used to show no pity, living life as a struggle, stuck on the block trying to stack and bubble. Found myself getting high just to relieve the pain. Stuck on stupid trying to gain, man, it's insane. But today's a brand new day and I'm focused on a new way. Looking on the other side, and yes, the grass is green, and evermore do I need to order that Tina.
My life's changed a lot since I've been in recovery, man. Being here with a lot of cool cats, like the boy that just spit the rhyme. It's cool to hear people sharing their struggles with other kids like that, man. If you're out there making mistakes, you know there's another way, because we're telling you right now there is. All I gotta say, man, my life's 100% better, dude. My PO's not on my back no more. She helping me. It's just a wonderful way of life. I hope you can get into it.
For more information on DePaul Treatment Center, check out their website, www.depaultreatmentcenters.org.
You are listening to The Underground, and
coming up next, Mike Clark interviews Follow of Azazel from Vancouver, Washington.
Hello and welcome to the Youth Randominium. What happened was we actually had the Youth National Conference kids coming around from across the country, and they were checking out the stations. They kicked us out and put us in Studio 2, so we actually had to do this pre-recorded. But what I actually have is Corey and band. What's the name of your band?
The Fall of Azazel.
The Fall of Azazel.
If you have a better band name, call it and let us know.
Yeah, let us know if you have a better band name for us.
A better band name for you. So have you guys done any, like, rock and roll concerts or anything like that, or what's... What have you guys been doing?
All the time. Screaming fans.
We played the Gorge once, didn't we?
We did play the Gorge once. But realistically, we've been playing at, like, the Portal and stuff like that in Vancouver, Washington.
That's awesome. So you guys are a Christian band, and you rock at the Gorge?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Bringing God's spirit through Vancouver, Washington?
Yep.
So what songs you guys? Have you guys done any CDs or anything lately? Or?
We're working on our demo right now, which should be ready in a few months. It's just a three-song demo.
So what are you guys' names? We didn't even actually get that.
I'm Corey Roberts, and I play guitar, and I sing.
Is this on?
Yeah, it's on.
I'm Nick Kanazzi, and I play bass.
He He's pretty good.
Thank you.
When he doesn't mess up.
What about you in the corner? What's your name?
I am Brian, and I play drums.
You're Brian, and I don't think it picked it up. I don't.
Okay. I am Brian, and I play drums.
You're Brian, and you play drums. So is this your whole band right here, you three guys,
yeah,
the Three Stooges? So why don't you go ahead and play us a song, Corey? Go ahead and strum the tunes here.
All righty. Called Let Me In, Push Me Out. Trust myself with hurting you. Maybe I think too much. I don't want to let something fall on my part. I want this to last forever, but that doesn't mean that you down. If it's possible for me to be part of your eternity, let me in, push me out. Whatever way this turns out,
something fall on my part. I want this to last forever. That doesn't mean I tied you down. If it's possible for me to be part of your eternity, let me in, push me out. Whatever way this turns out.
You got any more songs you guys want to play? I haven't heard from you two guys.
We're just hanging out.
We just do what Corey tells us to do.
You just do what Corey tells you.
Yes, he tells
him to do.
Yeah, that sounds kind of weird. I said, "Do you guys want to come?" And they said, "Yeah, we're not doing anything else."
Okay, you weren't supposed to say that part. We were very forced to come tonight.
You were forced to come tonight?
Yeah, so actually my other plans fell through. So
you guys didn't come on your own free will?
No.
Dude, I did. Actually, Brian loves the band that much that he would come on his own free will.
So, and you're Brian, right? The drummer?
Yes, that's me.
The drummer is Brian. All right, so what...
I actually had to get Corey to come.
So you guys do write your own songs, right?
Yeah, every song we write.
Every song, so if I was to check it, there's no plagiarism in there anywhere?
None.
Nothing like, did God tell you to write anything? Did
no.
it come to you? How do your songs come to you?
What I do is I write a lot of the actual music, like... You know, the chords and the notes and all that stuff, and then I'll just write it down. And so that way when I feel like writing a song, I don't have to worry about the music. I can just put all the words down and, I don't know.
It just happens.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I have to say, you guys...
at the same time.
That was amazing.
Happens.
You guys are pretty good. You guys are actually really good.
Well, you've only heard Corey. You haven't heard us. So.
I would bring a drum set in, but I can't really fit it in here.
Yeah, that's true.
I actually brought my drum set.
Oh, you could have brought your drum set. We probably have a cymbal in the newsroom if you want it.
There we go.
All right, the fellow Azazel, everybody. Go check them out in Vancouver, Washington. You guys are great.
MySpace. Next Friday. Yeah, if you guys are in Vancouver, we have a show next Friday at the Portal. It's kind of downtown Vancouver area. Just look it up online. It's called the Portal Cafe.
And what date is that?
April 28th.
April 28th, everybody go check them out.
At
8 o'clock.
You'll be a full band.
Full band.
It's only $50.
It's only
very
50
cheap.
Bucks. Wow.
Just kidding. It really doesn't cost.
It's
free.
Okay.
All right, so if you guys are in Vancouver, go ahead and check them out. So thanks, you guys. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
No problem. All right, we hope to see you guys soon. And actually, we'd like you guys to come back. That'd be awesome if you guys could come back.
And that was... The Fall of Azazel, an interview of them. Thanks for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday by the KABU Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KABU at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down. We are at KABU is at 20 Southeast 8th, or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032, extension 511. Or email her at kabuyouth@hotmail.com. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month from 11 to midnight. And we're always looking for new music by anyone under 21 of any style. And check out our website at kabuyouth.org. The first and third Wednesdays of the month, Circle A Radio airs at this time. And the second Wednesday of the month is Hole in the Bucket, a public affairs show on homelessness. And that it also airs from 6 to 7. Next up is DJ Audio with Nonstop Hip Hop. Thanks for listening.